The train is rolling at nearly 40 miles per hour. The next car is another fuel tanker. Leaping from one to the other at such speed would be suicidal. Enrique knows he could slip, fall between them, and be sucked under. He hears the men coming. Carefully, he jumps down onto the coupler that holds the cars together, just inches from the hot, churning wheels. He hears the muffled pop of gunshots and knows what he must do. He leaps from the train, flinging himself outward into the black void. That's a passage describing a Honduran boy's unsuccessful attempt after traveling thousands of miles, risking starvation, assault, mutilation, and death to reach his mother in America, a mother he hadn't seen for almost 12 years. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Los Angeles Times reporter Sonia Nazario won a Pulitzer Prize for her newspaper series tracing the harrowing journey of Enrique and thousands of other migrant children desperate to reunite with their mothers. Extremely poor, Central American mothers leave their children in order to try to earn money in America to send back home, but the separation has devastating consequences for the family. As part of her research for Enrique's journey, a series now expanded into a best-selling book, Sonia Nazario herself traveled more than 1,600 miles, half of that on top of trains. Enrique's journey has been chosen for the UW-Madison's Go Big Read campus-wide book selection for this year, and Sonia Nazario will be speaking in Madison on Thursday, October 27th at 7 p.m. at the Union South. She joins us by phone from her home in California.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You decided to write this book because of a direct story that you heard from a woman who was involved in the story?
Yes. Well, I've always been, I write about big social issues in the United States. I've always been very interested in the issue of immigration. But one morning, my house cleaner got him in. She would come and clean a couple of times a month, was at my home, and we were standing in my kitchen, and I asked her, Gottman, do you think you're going to have any more children? She would sometimes come with her young son, and I assumed this was her only child. And when I asked her this question, she was normally this very happy, very chatty woman, but she just went stone silent, and she started sobbing. And she explained to me that she was a single mother in Guatemala. Her husband had left her for another woman. Most days she could feed them once, maybe twice, but at night, oftentimes, her children cried with hunger, and she told me that morning in my kitchen how she would gently coax them to roll over in bed at night, and she would say to her children, sleep face down so your stomach won't growl so much. She said that she had left these four children in Guatemala. She had come north to work in Los Angeles and left them with her grandmother, and I remember her telling me how she had not seen her children in 12 years. This just amazed me. I couldn't comprehend how does a mom walk away from her kids, much less go 2,000 miles away, having no idea really when or if she's going to see her kids again. And it was really that initial conversation that piqued me about this issue, these women coming, leaving their children behind. A year later, her son came up on his own to come find his mother, wondering like all of these children do, whose mothers leave them in their home countries to come and work in the United States, does my mom really love me? You know, she said she was going to return quickly or send for me, and she hasn't. And he said, I came on these series of buses, but there are thousands of children making this incredible odyssey on top of freight trains through Mexico to come and find their moms in the United States. It seemed like an incredible story to me, an incredible story to tell.
What kind of trip to this country? We were talking about undocumented Latinos and Latinas in, I think, almost all cases here. What kind of trip did she herself have to get into this country?
My former house cleaner had come with a smuggler, and she had come a couple, 12 years before, so it had been much easier than it is now. And so it had not been particularly traumatic for her, obviously traumatic in terms of leaving her children and going 2,000 miles away. But in terms of the journey itself, nothing like what it is, even coming with a smuggler today, but certainly not coming with a smuggler and coming on top of freight trains, which is the preferred method for Central Americans if they don't have the money to pay for a smuggler.
You write in your prologue that one of your interests in doing the story also came from your own background. And you write, I know how difficult it is to straddle two countries, two worlds.
Yes, my father's family, I just learned earlier this year that my father was actually born in Syria, and he came as a baby to Argentina. They were fleeing Christian persecution in Syria. My mother's family left Poland when she was young to come to Argentina, and both of my parents had come to the United States, like many many immigrants seeking better opportunities, and of all places, they had come first to Madison, Wisconsin. My father was doing postdoc work in biochemistry and microbiology there, and I was actually born in Madison as part of that first trip to the United States. I'm the only person in my family born in the United States of the four children in my family, and so we went back and forth growing up between Madison, Kansas, and Argentina, and I always felt somewhat like I had one foot in both worlds, that I didn't truly belong in either place. Certainly, I felt I belonged more in the United States than in Argentina, but that sense of straddling two worlds and of feeling a little bit like the outsider. I mean, in Kansas, where I largely grew up, my parents would, they would roast whole goats on a cross in the backyard, and they would sit on their front lawn in their lawn chairs. Everyone sat in their backyard. My parents sat on the front lawn, and they would sip mate, which is a green tea that's sipped from a gourd with a silver straw. I mean, this was odd behavior in Kansas. We didn't quite fit in, and I somewhat reflected that in that my best friend was a Greek girl who lived down the block, so always kind of feeling the outsider.
And what are the conditions, if we go down to Central America, Mexico, that prevail today, conditions that would have prompted Enrique to come north? What is it like for the children in particular?
Well, I think many students that I speak to around the country, I think, don't really understand what's pushing people out of countries like Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Mexico. For a lot of children like Enrique, they are faced with eating once or twice a day. They are faced with only going to school till the third or fourth grade because they can't afford pencils, they can't afford paper, they can't afford the uniforms to go to school. In Enrique's neighborhood, the women who stay, the moms, those children end up working in this dump that's on top of this mountain, and trucks rumble up to the top of this hill, and women and kids would fight for position on either side of these trucks. As the trash would slide down, they were trying to pick out bits of tin or plastic or anything at all that they could sell. So I watched six-year-old children working in this dump, and it was something out of the inferno. I mean, I could not breathe in this place. It was such an assault on the senses. And so very difficult conditions.
I wanted to ask you about your decision as a reporter to go and, you just mentioned observing the poverty in Honduras, where Enrique was from. You also rode on trains. You put a lot of your own time, even your life at risk, to conduct this research. Can you talk about that decision?
Well, I was interviewing and writing about a 17-year-old boy, and as a reporter, these are the toughest interviews, 17-year-old boys. You know, they're not quite as verbal as one would like in terms of trying to write a detailed narrative. I was trying to make readers feel like they're sitting on top of that train with Enrique as he's making this journey through Mexico and experiencing, all the wonderful and terrible things that he experiences along the way. And I'm trying to make you feel like in those critical scenes along the way, the real turning points in this narrative, the high points, the low points, the places with the most conflict, you are in the middle of that. The book is written in present tense for that effect. And I just couldn't get enough details from Enrique to be able to do that. I mean, he was very helpful, but not to that degree. So I felt that if I reconstructed his story, if I went back and did it step by step, just like he had a few weeks before, I could get a lot more of those details, and I could really see what happens on top of that train. And a lot of those details I could take back to him and say, you know, did this happen in this place, yes or no? I was riding with many other children. I rode with a 12-year-old boy through parts of Mexico who was coming to find his mother in California. And so I could see what those children were going through. I think it was also very important for me to do the journey, not just to get those details, not just to be able to find people who he had interacted with along the way to reconstruct many of those scenes, but also to really write about this with a certain level of authority, because I had been through so much of this. I felt like I could write about it in a different way, and I could write about it with a real passion because, you know, I had had so many near misses along the way, and I knew that what I had been through was just one iota of what these kids go through. And so I think I came to write about it in a very different way than had I, you know, sat in Los Angeles and interviewed a boy who had just made this journey and not experienced or witnessed a lot of it myself.
Did you have any kind of a safety net, though? I mean, when you're riding, I mean, not literally, obviously, but when you're riding on the top of these trains with people, some of whom probably would just as soon kill you as ride along with you or steal you or whatever you have with you, did you have any kind of a backup as a journalist rather than a true undocumented immigrant?
I had some. They were not enough, but I had some. And I think I was, you know, honestly now engaging in some level of denial in terms of how dangerous this was going to be. I had spent months reporting before making this journey, and I had spent weeks inside ICE, our immigration detention centers. We now have more than 40 of shelters and detention centers just for children coming into this country, undocumented and without a parent from Central America and Mexico. And I had spent time in these places, and I had asked these children who I was interviewing, you know, tell me everything bad that happens at every point, so hopefully I can avoid those things. And so I knew that I was going to face bandits and gangsters atop the trains and corrupt cops, and it was going to be very difficult to get on and off these moving freight trains because you cannot the migrants get on them as they're moving because they're crossing Mexico illegally without permission. So I tried to build in some safety nets. In the southernmost state of Mexico, that's the worst of it, where the gangsters control the tops of the trains. And I knew that my odds of getting through that first of 13 states I would have to cross would be my odds of getting through it without getting raped were zero. And so I got this letter from the personal assistant to the president of Mexico. I obtained this letter saying, please treat this reporter well. And I used that letter to convince this immigrant rights group that at the time was armed, called Grupo Beta, to ride with me on top of the trains just for that first state. And so I had six guys with me with AK-47s. They were not happy to go up on the trains with me because and had not patrolled the train tops in 14 months because despite having AK-47s, they would get shot at by these gangsters that prowl on top of the trains and rob migrants on top of the trains. But they did come up with me, and when I could see on those rides in southern Mexico, gangsters knifing people on top of the train, robbing them. But when they would get too close to my car, these guys I was with would shoot off rounds into the air to warn them not to get any closer. That was very, very helpful. But north of that, the other 12 states, I was pretty much riding only with immigrants. The first time I did this journey was for a newspaper series, and I rode with a photojournalist, but he was usually on a different part of the train because, understandably, he didn't want me right in the middle of his shot. So I was usually riding with other migrants. I got permission from all four train companies that I was going to be riding on top of their trains, and I had, you know, I had told the train conductors, if you see me waving this red rain jacket I have madly, you know, that means something bad is happening. Please help me. What I didn't realize is that bad things happen very quickly, and trains stop very slowly, and so this was really a fairly idiotic idea, but I, at least in my mind, I thought I had some safety nets going for me.
Well, you write in your prologue that you are not brave, but I would beg to differ. It seemed to me it would take a tremendous amount of courage to do what you did.
Well, I felt passionately about writing about this issue. I felt that it was important to show what is pushing people out of countries like Honduras, where there's, you know, 44% unemployment and subemployment compared to our 9% unemployment in this country, and the incredible poverty I had seen, and the women who would tell me that when their children cried at night with hunger, they would fill up this big glass with water with a little teaspoon of sugar, a dollop of tortilla dough, you know, whatever they could give their children to quiet their cries of hunger. I felt it was important to show people what immigrants are willing to do to get through Mexico, that incredible determination that I saw. And when you see that, I think that when I saw that, you really come to understand that no wall is going to stop someone that determined. And I felt it was important to show Americans who our new neighbors are, of the 11 million people who are here without papers, without permission. 51% of them are now women and children, and this is a huge change from when it was largely men coming to this country in that way. So I thought, and as the hostility towards immigrants has been growing in this country in recent years, I thought that it was important to show the face and take people inside one immigrant family. So to me, it was an important story to tell. It was also, from a writer's perspective, a great story to tell from a storytelling perspective. So I had strong motivations to tell the story, and honestly, it didn't seem as dangerous at the time. I mean, I had a few near misses where for about 60 seconds I thought to myself, wow, that could have gone the other way and that would have been very, very bad. But it didn't seem as bad in the moment as now when I talk about it and people look at me like I'm a little nuts.
Right. But,
It seemed like it was worth what I was doing. Now, I would not do this journey now. Today, the Zetas, the worst narco-trafficking cartel, controls the train tops, and along with the gangsters, and they infiltrate at the train stations the immigrants so that they know who has money, who has relatives in the United States, because people are buying, you know, a Coca-Cola or whatever. They know where you're hiding your money, and so when the train stops, they pull up with these vans, they grab people, they take them to a secure home, lock them up, and they use that slip of paper migrants carry with their relatives' phone number on it to demand ransom of those relatives in the United States, $1,000 to $5,000. And if you don't pay, sometimes if you do pay, they kill you. And there are 20,000 Central Americans being kidnapped in Mexico each year. It's a human rights disaster that's occurring south of our border with very little publicity to what's happening there now. And so now, for me, it would be suicidal to make this journey.
Can you talk about how you selected Enrique and to what extent he is a stand-in for thousands of children?
There is an army of children heading north each year. Those children are on top of freight trains right now in Mexico, making their way north to try to reach their parents in the United States in many cases. That number has actually grown. Although the number of undocumented migrants has dropped by about two-thirds in recent years, as people have heard that there aren't a whole lot of jobs in the United States right now, and so they're coming in fewer numbers, the number of children has actually grown. And so there's about 100,000 children who come to the United States without permission each year from Central America and Mexico, a huge number of children. And so Enrique was meant to stand in for those children who are coming here in search of their mothers. And I, as a journalist, I'm looking for the typical scenario amongst these children. The average age of a child that ICE catches coming into the United States alone without either parent is 15, a boy. And I was looking for one coming on the trains looking for mom. And so that's what I set out to find. And when I realized there's no way I can find a boy in Central America and stick with him running from all these people trying to harm these child migrants as they travel through Mexico, the bandits, the cops, the gangsters, etc., I can't run as fast as a 15-year-old and keep up with them. So I resolved to find a boy who had made it to northern Mexico on the Mexican side of the border and hope that that child would make it onto their mom in the United States and then go back and reconstruct their journey. I figured out all the shelters and churches on that 2,000-mile border on the Mexican side and started calling and those shelter and church directors and saying, I'm looking for this in particular. And this nun in Nuevo Laredo, across from Laredo, Texas, at a church said, I have this boy here. He's 17, but let me put him on the phone with you. And I really liked Enrique. He was very honest. His story was typical in terms of what he had been through. I mean, he was on his eighth attempt to get through Mexico, eight. He had almost been beaten to death on top of this train. He was on his second month. He had been on the road for 2 months. And so I thought he really showed how arduous this journey is for these children. I was a little worried that he was a little older than I wanted. He was 17. He started his journey when he was 16. But I thought, well, I'll go hang out with him in Nuevo Laredo, and I'll keep searching for my younger ideal child. And when I got there, I spent 2 weeks really attached at the hip to Enrique, but still looking for that younger child. And when I learned that Enrique was a glue sniffer, that in Honduras, without his mother and father there, he had turned to drugs for solace, that really worried me, honestly, because I thought, well, you know, who's going to be able to identify and empathize with a 17-year-old glue sniffer? So I searched even harder for that younger, angelic child. And I think at a certain point, my editor then at the Los Angeles Times said, you know, well, why was Enrique a glue sniffer? I said, well, a lot of these children without their mom or dad there, they do get in trouble. They do get into drugs. And he said, you know, the best characters in literature are not little angels. They're flawed. They're deeply flawed. We as readers cannot identify with someone who's perfect. Go with Enrique. And I think it was at that point that I decided to go with him. Also, I was interviewing these younger children coming through that church, 13, 14 years old. All of them had been robbed of their slip of paper that these children carry with their mother's phone number on it in the United States. And they were robbed of that by the gangsters or the bandits or others on their journey. And they were realizing, I don't remember a phone number in my home country. There is no telephone in my tiny little town. And it was dawning on them that they were going to have to, after months of travel through Mexico, they were going to have to go back to the beginning in Central America and start their journey all over again. So for those variety of factors, I settled on Enrique. And it was a good choice, I think, not only because he's not a perfect little angel, but also when people say, well, you know, you were trying to put the best face on immigrants, you were trying to humanize immigrants, God forbid, I say, well, you know, I wrote about a glue sniffer.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard also to imagine anyone being very innocent and being able to survive the perils that are likely to come up on that long trip. We'll look at the journey of Enrique into this country when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year.
Chapter 1, The Boy Left Behind. The boy does not understand. His mother is not talking to him. She will not even look at him. Enrique has no hint of what she is going to do. Lourdes knows. She understands, as only a mother can, the terror she is about to inflict, the ache Enrique will feel, and finally, the emptiness. What will become of him? Already he will not let anyone else feed or bathe him. He loves her deeply, as only a son can. With Lourdes, he is openly affectionate. Give me a kiss, Mom, he pleads over and over, pursing his lips. With Lourdes, he is a chatterbox. Look, Mom, he says softly, asking her questions about everything he sees. Without her, he is so shy it is crushing. Slowly, she walks out onto the porch. Enrique clings to her pant leg. Beside her, he is tiny. Lourdes loves him so much, she cannot bring herself to say a word. She cannot carry his picture. It would melt her resolve. She cannot hug him. He is 5 years old. That's from the opening of the first chapter of Enrique's journey by author Sonia Nazario, who is our guest on University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we're talking about this incredible odyssey of a Honduras boy to reach his mother in America. It is so heart-wrenching, I think, to hear this tale of a five-year-old boy who has no clue that his mother is about to leave him and that she'll be gone for almost 12 years. What was Enrique's life like during those 11 years that he was in Honduras without his mother? And what led him to decide to make the journey?
Well, I think he's devastated by his mother's absence. He is incredibly lonely without her. Before she left, she would sell items from a wooden box on the dusty sidewalks of the capital of Honduras, Tegucigalpa. And he would play alongside her morning, afternoon, and night as she sold things. And suddenly, his mother has just disappeared. And initially, he's left with his paternal grandmother and his father, but then his father leaves to start a family with a new wife and has children with her, and the new wife doesn't want Enrique's father to have a real relationship with Enrique, so he doesn't. And Enrique gets raised largely by his paternal grandma. When he's 11 and 12 years old, on Christmas morning, he stands at the door of his grandma's wooden shack, and he prays to God for Christmas, please return my mother to me. And he gets past, he becomes, quite honestly, a pretty troubled boy without his mother there. He gets passed from relative to relative, and he gets in a lot of trouble, and he comes to see his mother really as his salvation. If he can only reach her in the United States, then everything will be right with the world. And honestly, he idealizes her. And so after 11 years of not seeing her, he sets off to go find her. And like all of these children, he wants answered that one question, you know, does she honestly, truly love me? Because like many of these women, Lourdes, his mom, left thinking, you know, I'll be gone a year or 2 years at the most. But life here in the U.S. is a lot tougher than immigrants think it's going to be. And so these separations for these children from their mothers typically, I found, stretch 5 or 10 years or even more. And these kids, like Enrique, he despaired of being with his mother again and set off to go find her.
Now, there was no complete loss of contact with his mother, was there? Not for a terribly long part of that period of time anyway. She was sending money, she was sending gifts?
She was sending money and gifts when she could, and she was trying to send money also for Enrique's sister to be able to attend a private high school and to even be able to go on to college for a year or two. And so there was that contact, but there was no phone inside Enrique's paternal grandmother's home, and so that communication was very difficult at times. And like many women who come here, Lourdes would balance, do I spend the money to make those phone calls every week or every 2 weeks to my child, or do I try to save more quickly that $8,000 that I have to pay the smuggler to try to bring each of my children north from Honduras? And so that's a calculation that a lot of these mothers face here in the United States. And, you know, life is very difficult for them here, and it's gotten much harder now with this crackdown that we're seeing across the country on the local and state level towards undocumented or illegal immigrants. But a lot of these women are trying to pay their bills here, send money back to their children, $100 each month, and save that amount for the smugglers. And juggling those three things can be very difficult.
And the trend, you say, has changed over the years from single men going north into this country looking for work to, well, first women and then children who are actually not looking for work so much as trying to put their family back together?
Some of these children who are coming in search of work. Some of them are fleeing abusive situations in their home countries. Some of them are now fleeing gang violence in their home countries, that they're being recruited by the gangs, and they're fleeing to the United States to try to avoid that situation. But I found that the majority were coming to reunify with a parent. For the Central American children, 3 and 4 were coming to find a mom who had left them behind.
And how much, if you look at it objectively and you put aside the fact that it causes such an ache, such a desolate sense of loss for the child left behind, but how much did it help? This money that was coming back from America, what difference did it make in the life of Enrique and his sister?
Well, for Enrique, that money ensured many days that he was able to eat and that he was able to study. He really quit studying because it was more his decision as he became more troubled than anything else. That money did give him the promise of being able to complete school in Honduras. It provided, you know, Nike shoes and soccer balls and a little television set. And so in a material sense, this can be huge for these children. And I don't want to minimize that in any way, but I've interviewed hundreds of these kids, and to a one, they would tell me, I would have rather had my mom stay with me by my side to love me, to protect me as I was growing up, than had her sending those shoes and even the money to eat. And these separations, if you are apart from your children for 5 or 10 years, what I saw was that there was enormous resentment, ultimately, by these children towards their mothers. I watched a boy in Los Angeles say to his mom's face, even a dog doesn't leave its litter. And I found what was very sad about these separations was that in the end, these moms are losing the one thing that is most important to them oftentimes, the love of their children. It does not often have a happy ending. And so I insisted that this book be simultaneously published in Spanish in the United States and also in Latin America be published because I wanted Latinas to understand, yes, you know the benefits of coming here and being able to send that money, and your children do eat and study, but you should also know that if you leave your children for 10 years, they will resent and walk up to the line of hating you for it. They do not understand it, and you have these huge conflicts in these homes when these children finally reunify with their mothers. They say, you know, where were you? You said you were coming right back. You abandoned me. And the mothers are equally belligerent. They say, you know, I did this all for you. Enrique's mother lived for, nearly 12 years with a photo album with a dozen photographs of her two children. And that was it. And those phone calls occasionally. And she felt she had made the ultimate sacrifice for her children and that Enrique, when he arrived, should be, you know, incredibly grateful for what she had done. And he obviously does not feel that way.
They had different priorities, at least on the face of it. There was some irony there, too, in that at times Enrique's mother was taking care of the children of well-to-do people in one place or another, and those children were missing their parents, and she thought, well, why am I taking care of these children instead of my own?
Yes, and in fact, my house cleaner, who originally gave me the idea for this story, when she told me she had left her children in Guatemala and she had not seen these kids in 12 years, I had a somewhat judgmental tone in my voice asking her about this. And she responded, well, you know, there's a lot of women here in the United States who are middle class, upper middle class, and they go off and they do these high career jobs and they spend 10 or 12 hours a day doing this and they leave their children at home for 10 or 12 hours a day. You know, if I lived in this country with my children, she said, and, I had the means to do it, I would spend a whole lot more time with my children than these women that I see who are careerists and spend so much time during their day away from their children. So it was an interesting response that she had, and she could hear that judgmental tone in my voice, and that's what prompted her to say, you know, it's not just me that's done this. There are millions of women like me, who single mothers, who have left their children in their home countries to come here and hopefully provide a better life for those children.
Did Enrique tell anybody he was going to try to come to this country?
He told some friends, and initially in Honduras, and he told his girlfriend in Honduras. So he did clue people in. They didn't quite all of them believe that he was going to do it, but he did tell a few people, and he went and said goodbye to his paternal grandmother before leaving.
Did anybody try to stop him?
No, no one really tried to stop him. I think they didn't really believe that he was going to do it, and I think, honestly, he was having a lot of trouble with drugs and sniffing glue, and so they weren't really quite sure what to believe.
In your book, you include at the front a map, and it really struck me just looking at the distance from Honduras to Texas, which wasn't even the end of his journey, but just the scale of that. I wonder if you could, just to bring it home to those of us without geography in the forefront of our mind, how long a journey it was? Because sometimes when we see him get sent all the way back after the fifth or sixth or seventh time, to just it's staggering to think of how many miles he actually traveled. If you were going to take the same distance from Madison, for example, where would you end up?
Well, you would be across the width of the United States, you would be crossing more than half of that distance. And so that space, crossing half of the United States, takes, you know, 3 or 3.5 hours in an airplane. So it's an enormous distance. He would start in Honduras, and he took buses through all of Honduras, all of Guatemala. He crosses a river on a makeshift, most migrants try to cross on a makeshift boat, but he wades across this wide river, and now he's in Mexico, and he's got to go through 13 states of Mexico to get to northern Mexico, which is where I met him. And even there, he still had to cross into the United States and reach North Carolina, where his mother is, and travel across Texas and much of the American South to Florida, where someone ends up picking him up. So these were enormous distances.
And you talk about some of the things he endures, like getting stung by bees, getting robbed, getting beaten. I wonder if you could read, it's from page 51 of your book, but just some of the, I think it's when he's sent home for the sixth time after thousands of miles of enduring incredible obstacles. If you could read a little bit from that, describing the sixth journey and how he almost succeeded, but is sent back.
On his sixth attempt, he nearly succeeded. It took him more than 5 days. He crossed 1,564 miles. He reached the Rio Grande and actually saw the United States. He was eating alone near some railroad tracks when Migra agents grabbed him. They sent him to a detention center called El Corralón, the Corral, in Mexico City. The next day, they bused him for 14 hours all the way back to Guatemala. The bus unloaded him back across the Rio Suchiate in the rugged frontier town of El Carmen. The river marks the Guatemalan border, just as the Rio Grande defines the Mexican border to the north. A sign in block letters on top of a hill says, "Bienvenidos a Guatemala." It was as if he had never left. He has slept on the ground in a sewage culvert, curled up with other migrants, on top of gravestones. Once, on top of a moving train, he grew so hungry that he jumped forward to the first car, leaped off, and raced to pick a pineapple. He was able to reboard one of the train's last cars. Another time, he had gone 2 days without water. His throat felt as if it was swelling shut. There were no houses in sight. He found a small cattle trough. It was frothy with cow spit. Under the froth was green algae. Beneath the algae was stagnant yellow water. He brought handfuls to his parched lips. He was so thirsty, it tasted wonderful. Each time he is deported, Enrique knows he must quickly get back over the river into Mexico, away from Guatemala's lawless border towns. Once he was deported at 2 a.m. and spent the night cowering, sleepless, near the border guard station, afraid for his life.
It's just incredible what he endured.
It was amazing. When I met Enrique in northern Mexico, I was just incredibly moved by what this kid had gone through. I mean, he was on his eighth attempt to get through Mexico, and he was barely eating once a day, and he was sleeping outside on this wet mattress by the river that separates Mexico from the United States. And, you know, he had been nearly beaten to an inch of his life on top of this freight train. He was on the road for 2 months already. It would end up taking him 122 days and 12,000 miles in what really it is a modern-day odyssey these kids go on to try to reach their moms in the U.S. And for Enrique, it was just an incredible journey of many lows and some highs as well.
So how did he manage actually to get into this country? Was there inevitably some luck involved, I'm sure, but he obviously was learning lessons each time he got sent back.
I think all of these migrants, and Enrique included, they learn what to do and what not to do, which gives you a little better shot at making it through Mexico. But So, and Enrique did learn along the way. He learned which trains to take. He learned where to hide, to sleep in sewage culverts, to hide from the immigration authorities. He learned that you should ride the train even if your feet are soggy and wet, to keep your shoes on so that when that train stops and the immigration agents and the judicial police try to grab you, hopefully you can run faster and elude them. So he did pick up a lot of knowledge along the way, and ultimately he is able to call his mother when he's on that northern border of Mexico and ask her finally for help, for money, for a smuggler to get him across the last stretch, to get him across the Rio Grande and get him into the United States with the use of a smuggler. And that's what ultimately helps him make that final journey to his mother's arms.
But those smugglers, the coyotes, are not terribly reliable either, though. It's still a bit of a crapshoot. You can give the money without knowing at all whether you're going to get anything for it.
It's a total crapshoot. Many of them are very corrupt, these smugglers, and the ideal is to find a smuggler in your home country who has a given track record, and you know from others that smuggler is reliable. He'll take your money, but he'll promise you to get you there. Oftentimes, smugglers promise, "I'll try three times to get you into the United States. I'll keep trying until I get you in there for this fee, $5,000, $8,000 from Honduras, depending on if you're a child or an adult." But Enrique was taking a chance and going with the smuggler who he had met on the border, who was a drug addict himself. But Enrique had seen that he would take people across the border and those people would not come back. And so to him, that was a good sign that this guy had a good track record.
And even though he did meet some corrupt policemen, some terrible gangsters, all kinds of lows along the way, as you mentioned, there were highs, including people who would throw food and kindly priests and others who had started shelters. Were you struck by the generosity along the way as well?
I met some of the most generous people I've ever encountered in my life in Mexico. When you go through southern Mexico in Chiapas, and most of these kids are beaten or robbed several times, the studies show, before they get out of that first state that they have to cross in Mexico. That really is the heart of darkness, and you come out of that, I did, just thinking, man, the world is all dark, and there is no hope for humanity. And then you reach south central Mexico to Veracruz, where there are curves in the tracks, or for some reason that train had to slow down. And in a lot of these little towns in those places, when people heard the whistle of the train, I'd watch 10 or 20 or 30 people rush out of their homes with these bundles of food in their arms. And they would wave and they'd smile and shout to these migrants atop the trains. They threw bread, they threw tortillas, sandwiches, whatever they had, fruit, oranges, pineapples. When I was atop the train, they were pelting me with these big bunches of bananas. If they don't have food, they would throw bottles of tap water. And if they didn't have any water, I would watch people in these little towns come out along the rails, and they would give a silent prayer for these migrants as they passed by. What really amazed me were these were the poorest Mexicans who live along the rails. I mean, folks who make a dollar a day, and they could barely feed their own children. But they made a point of giving to these total strangers from other lands who they were never going to see again. And they said, you know, I am doing this because this is the Christian thing to do. This is the correct thing to do. This, I know, is what Jesus would do if he were standing in my shoes. It was incredible to me to see that generosity. And I think that generosity was reflected when different leaders of different churches in Alabama facing this very tough law in Alabama that said you cannot drive someone who's undocumented, you cannot feed someone who's undocumented. The clergy rose up, the bishops, and said, this violates God's laws. We are instructing people not to follow these laws if they are passed in Alabama, if they are sanctioned by the courts, because we believe that God's law is more important. So it was very interesting to me to see what was happening with the clergy in Alabama, given what I had seen in Mexico.
We'll see how Enrique's journey to the United States to find his mother plays out when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Sonia Nazario, who has written the book Enrique's Journey, the subtitle of which is The Story of a Boy's Dangerous Odyssey to Reunite with His Mother. We're seeing documentation from journalists, Margaret Regan and, of course, you too, among them. Is it still too early, do you think, Sonia, to see writings from people who've gone through this experience themselves, the actual immigrants?
I think we're on the cusp of seeing that, but we haven't seen a lot of that yet. I think I see him with a very good friend of mine, Reina Grande. She came here at the age of 9, undocumented. She was left behind first by her father and then by her mother and made this very difficult journey. And she's written about it in a more fictionalized way, Across 100 Mountains, very similar in certain ways to Enrique's journey. But I think largely now we're having other people tell migrant stories. And hopefully we will move into having more and more migrants tell their own stories in powerful ways so that we can educate the American public more and more. I think a lot of the discussions about immigration, a lot of the views that people have really come from a lack of knowledge and an information vacuum on both sides of the political divide, honestly. I think if people understood more about the immigrant experience and what's drawing people here, then I think we'd make we would understand migrants a lot better, and we would make smarter policy choices in terms of this immigration debate that's been very contentious in Wisconsin, despite the fact that, you know, there's maybe 100,000 undocumented immigrants in Wisconsin, about 2% of the population. That's about half of what we see elsewhere in the country. But despite that, obviously, Representative Sensenbrenner has led efforts to crack down on undocumented immigrants in his 2005 bill that would have turned all undocumented immigrants into felons. And he's obviously doing that because he believes that some portion of the public in Wisconsin wants him to do that. And yet many have a very welcoming attitude towards immigrants in Wisconsin. And also many industries see these immigrants as critical. In the dairy industry, for example, is now freaking out over the prospect of a bill passing Congress called E-Verify that would call for all new hires of any business in this country to have their social security number run through a computerized system that determines if you're here legally or not. And if you're not, you cannot be hired. And, many dairy farmers and the like, this is a $26 billion industry in Wisconsin, are very fearful that this is going to do in their industry, and we won't be able to have a dairy industry in Wisconsin if you had to pay much higher wages to attract American workers to do all of those jobs. So this is a very contentious issue even in Wisconsin.
You write in your book toward the end that we seem to purposely have a schizophrenic immigration policy. And you write, in essence, politicians have put a lock on the front door while swinging the back door wide open. How so?
I think that much of our immigration policies have been driven by businesses' desire to have cheap, compliant workers, and they find a way to do that. And so even though this E-Verify bill that would require all, that is pending in Congress, would require all businesses to run someone through this computer system, there are also two guest worker bills pending in Congress that would each allow 500,000 guest worker migrants to come in each year to pick those crops and to work in those dairy farms. And so I think businesses, they like undocumented immigrants because they're exploitable. They will work for lower wages. And while we try to promote policies and political leaders say, oh, no, we're trying to bar the door and keep people from coming here in this way, we have somehow found ways for people to enter the United States and fill these jobs. I believe that there are many jobs that immigrants do that Americans would do if they were paid a living wage to do them. But there are many other jobs that I have seen that are very, very difficult jobs that I think it would be hard to get Americans to do unless you paid such a high wage that it would basically price those types of industries out of business, and we would instead outsource those types of businesses, or those businesses would shut down altogether. So I do believe that much of our policies have been driven by trying to keep that that back door crack so that these businesses can get what they feel they need.
Do you think the story of Enrique is one that would be a positive message to those back in Honduras or south of the border who want to come this way?
I think Enrique's story is a cautionary tale for them in terms of what you have to go through to get through Mexico and what you must face, and especially now with the narco traffickers controlling the tops of the trains. Enrique's mother, Lourdes, is now married to her longtime boyfriend, Fausto. And Fausto's brother recently sent his son north, his 18-year-old son, with four other people. And 8 months ago, as they were making their way through Mexico, they disappeared. And they hope that instead of being killed by those narco traffickers, being kidnapped, they never got a ransom call. They hope that they have enslaved him to work growing drugs in Mexico or selling drugs, which is sometimes the case, and that he's still alive. But for 8 months, they've heard nothing from him. So I think it's a cautionary tale. But if you ask Enrique now, as I have, he would say it was worth it. He reached his mother. He is happy that he is with her. He loves her very much. And he feels that in the end, that journey was worth it. So his tale is a story with shades of gray, as is the case with the immigration issue. I think there are winners and losers in terms of this influx. It's a very complicated issue.
Some of the losers include the children that you mentioned who lose legs, who lose arms, who lose their lives to those trains.
I think certainly some of the losers are immigrants who lose their lives along the way, who are mutilated by the trains. I saw so much of this. I spent time in a shelter in southern Mexico that was filled with people with no arms and legs. I think the losers are the immigrants themselves when they end up having these ill feelings towards their mothers. And I think some of the losers also, there are many winners in America in terms of these immigrants, people middle class on up who can avail themselves of the kinds of products and services that immigrants do for cheaper wages in this country. Businesses are winners, but the losers are Americans who don't have high school degrees, who have sometimes had to compete in the same types of jobs as immigrants, as in construction. 1 in 7 construction workers, 1 in 4 roofers is undocumented, and wages in meatpacking plants, in construction, in other areas have been depressed, down 8% over all those industries that immigrants have gone into, the wages over 20 years because of that influx of immigrants. And so I think it does hurt the poor in this country, this influx of immigrants.
You consider Enrique's journey a cautionary tale. You wanted it published in Spanish at the same time as published in English so that people south of the border who might be thinking of coming this way would know of the dangers and the costs. But do you think the people most likely to come north are likely to read your book?
I think there's much more discussion now in Central America about the costs, and I'm very happy to see that. I mean, I think my former house cleaner is perhaps the most cautionary tale about what can happen. I had heard in high schools in California and Texas, the worst thing that a child can do to get back at their mom for leaving them is to have an affair with the mother's husband. My former house cleaner, Carmen, had a husband here in the United States for 15 years. He was from Guatemala as well. I saw her in Iowa where she had moved with her husband to work in the meatpacking plants. And we were going to speak together at a college, and I asked her, how are things going? And she said, you know, everyone here at the meatpacking plant has, I've learned what everyone there already knew. My two daughters, I finally brought them up legally, and my oldest daughter, to get back at me, had an affair with my husband. Mm. And I kicked my husband out yesterday, and I'm sending the two girls back to Guatemala tomorrow. If I knew then what I know now, I would not have left my children. This has destroyed my family. I know how the story ends, and yet I have never been a woman standing in a place like Honduras with children and with those children crying with hunger and with the cupboards bare and wondering, how am I going to feed these kids? Even knowing how Carmen, my house cleaner's story ends, I might have made the same decision that she made. I think it's very difficult to know until you're in these women's shoes.
Thank you, Sonia Nazario, for being our guest and for your really courageous work on Enrique's journey.
It's been delightful to be here.
Sonia Nazario will be speaking in Madison on Thursday, October 27th at 7 p.m. at the Union South on the Madison campus as part of Go Big Read. She joined us from California. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next University of the Year.